truly appreciate it. I have to say that I am allergic to citrus fruit.
Oh, no,
over here. It's so mine.
This is like the Lord of the Flies. Why don't you just share?
He's got a box of Thin Mints over there.
It's true.
Where'd you find Thin Mints?
None of the Girl
Scouts.
He gave them to me
for a grapefruit.
Right down
the street.
All right,
so
you
can share them. We have Carmelites. We have not found Thin Mints.
You're a
chump. I'll get you the Thin Mints.
That doesn't even sound like a healthy habit.
Do you realize this is what they're taking down?
I want Thin Mints.
I want grapefruit. I want the... I think you should have it split between all of you.
Yeah, share it.
Maybe we'll do that after class. I don't know how you do it.
I can cut it up.
Can you cut it up so that everybody gets peace?
You're going to get thrown out of school with
sure.
Okay. There you are.
Cereal.
Actually, as long as I don't bring some kind of chemical explosive device on campus, it's pretty hard for me to get kicked out of the weapons charge.
Doesn't everybody have a
the University of Michigan is explicitly exempted from the state law because the Chinese department complained about having huge swords on campus.
Oh my gosh.
I'm sorry.
That's cool.
They complained about that?
I don't mind any grief.
Well, because the Japanese department has the swords, and the Chinese department was complaining. Because Japan kept invading China.
No.
Okay, can I explain to you what I was like? Because I felt really bad about it. One thing about this class is that I use slides. The problem is that a lot of times the slides I want to use are already being used by another class. So I have a meeting just before this class. I have to hot foot it over to Tappan, get the slides, and wrench them sometimes from the people who have them, which means I have to run around upstairs and say, do you have this? Do you have that? And then I grab them. So this today was really awful. But you have the slides. I want you to know. You've got them. I pride them.
You feel special.
That's the pirate.
In fact, Kathy, you probably saw something this morning that I pried away.
No? I had an exam this morning.
Oh, you did? How'd it go?
It went.
going.
That's a good example.
Good.
All right, today we're going to talk. I really wish we could have class outside, but we can't.
You can put it on the wall or something.
No way, Jose. And especially after I've done all this trouble, guys, you've got to. So what I need you to do is make your little, just widen the circle a bit and pay attention to the screen. And we'll talk through this. Today we're going to talk about the medium of sculpture. Do you know what this tell me your name again?
Janino.
This is a kind of an introduction to theory of art and And we've been talking about each individual medium. We're going to see some really beautiful things today, I have to say. I really wish that we could... Oh, no.
What'd you do with that?
I forgot.
Bye, Beth.
All right, now. Okay, so today we're going to talk about sculpture. And unfortunately, as I said, we have to use slides. We can't be in front of the objects. But we do have some nice slides, so it's not going to be too bad. And hopefully you've done, although I know it's midterm week, so my guess is you haven't done your reading from Taylor. Is that right?
I did it all.
Who's done the reading from Taylor? Whoa. Wait, say that again. Let me see. Taylor. Excellent. This week, that's good. So how are you finding Taylor anyway?
Subpar.
What?
Subpar.
Subpar?
Par.
Hard?
Par.
Subpar. Oh, under par. Okay. Yeah, no, he's not a thrilling writer, I would say. But it's very useful information, and I don't know of another one that does that, unfortunately.
Part is that list in the back. It's awesome.
No, that's bad.
To be able to cross all the music and the...
I would have walked in
there. Yeah, that is the
art.
No, I'm
not sure.
All right.
You were all making so much noise about you wanted some of this paper.
You are.
This is the grapefruit class.
Exactly.
What?
You said you wanted some.
Speaking of
no,
allergies.
Okay.
I said it was a bad fiction.
This is the one
no,
characteristic of sculpture that is completely different from any other media we've had so far. It's kind of illustrated on the screen. Do you know what that is?
Different perspectives.
Say that again.
Being able to see it from various perspectives.
Yeah. So you have to see, yeah. It's three-dimensional. And the thing is that with a three-dimensional object, that alters your analysis of it considerably, and that really makes it, it's a huge difference in the way you approach sculpture, the way you approach painting or graphic or the graphic arts. We're really moving into the round. And in order really to deal with sculpture, you have to be able to see it from all the angles that it's meant to be seen from, which means that your analysis, it kind of compounds the problem. You look at it from the front, but then you really have only done half of it. You've got to go around the back and take a look at what is there, unless the sculpture is frontally, meant to be frontal and frontally placed. Mm-hmm. Now, most of the sculpture that we looked at in the Greek period, in the ancient period, when I showed you the Parthenon sculptures, were actually meant to be seen only from the front. But things like the Venus of Willendorf, which is actually held in the hand, is meant to be not only seen from all angles, but handled. And so you have to really take that into consideration. I'm just showing you one classical example. You should get shown in every art history class, or I think you do. Kathy, have you seen this yet?
I think so, but
this is the rapist. This is the second part of your midterm. This is by Giovanni da Bologna, which is really John from Bologna. So there's Giovanni. It's D-A-B-O-L.
Bologna.
Bologna, like, not like bologna, but
it's
like.
It's the same way. That's where
bologna
comes from.
Bologna.
Same way.
Yeah. Yeah. Same way.
You spell
bologna in America.
B A L O N N Y. No, nobody spells it like that.
That's the American.
It depends. You can get all the
process.
The name of the piece is The Rape of the Sabines. And it's The Rape of the Sabines. The Rape of the Sabines is not a biblical story. It is a, anybody know? How would you figure out the iconography of this? It's hard, I think, if you have never heard of The Rape of the Sabines.
Is it Greek?
Greek?
Greek
no, but close.
Roman.
It's Roman, yeah. It's an ancient ancient Roman subject. It actually is a historical event in which two tribes, one of which was called the Sabines, and I don't know what the other one was called, but anyway, they were invaded, and the Sabine women were all taken by the other tribe. They were raped, and they were brought back to live with that tribe, and they had children. And when the Sabine tribe attacked the other tribe to get their women back. The women stood between the warring factions because their children, because they wanted to protect their children. So the notion is that these women are protecting their children even though they've been raped by the other. It's quite a nice story. Anyway, I mean, the rape part isn't, but what the women did is very nice.
Look how they're dressed.
What?
I said, well, look how they're dressed. They were asking for it. Don't make any clothes.
What? Just trying to start
But we're not actually going to concentrate on this because we don't have that many good slides. And it's, but what's important about it again is that if you here's the back view and here's the front view, you really can't tell what's going on until you've actually surfaced the sculpture. Here's a Sabine woman being taken away by the attacking tribe, and a Sabine man being pushed down by the attacker.
Week after
Brexit.
Don't say
queen. All right. So the point I just want to make is that always the first thing you need to think about is to look at it from multiple angles. Okay. Now we're going to go on and talk about the materials of sculpture. And again, remember when we talked about painting, we divided it into water-based paint and oil-based. Pigment, oil mixed pigment. We're going to divide sculpture equally into these two huge categories. One is what Taylor calls additive. That is sculpture that's made up with the building up of form. So additive, A-D-D-I-T-I-V-E. And the other is? Excellent! You got it! Subtractive. Additive and subtractive, which means sculpture that's made by the taking away of forms. Okay, and you really pretty much can divide sculpture into these two categories. But each of them, depending on whether you are an additive sculptor or a subtractive sculptor, I think the name Taylor uses the term glyptic and haptic, which I think is kind of unnecessarily complex. Additive and subtractive is pretty reasonable. Should I spell glyptic for you?
It's
in the arena. Anyway, so what we're going to do is we're going to look at subtractive, and we're going to look at carving. We're going to start out with a really spectacular example. Look at it carefully. This is a sculpture by Michelangelo, and it's called The Bearded Bubbly Slave. And you just don't, and let me tell you why. It's called The Bearded, it's bearded. The slave is bearded. It is an unfinished sculpture by Michelangelo. Let me write his name on the board. I'm pretty sure you can. Michelangelo. And you can just call it a bubbly slave. And the reason is...
Oh, bubbly.
Yeah, bubbly. The reason is because the slaves are owned by the Bubbly family. That's right, the Italian family, rich family, the Bubblies. There's a bubbly... If you go to Florence, there's a Bubbly Gardens also. In association with that family. Now the thing about this wonderful bubbly slave, is that it is unfinished. And so what we get to do is we get to actually see Michelangelo at work. This is a way of getting into the process of how this extraordinary sculpture works. But it also illustrates a real problem of subtractive sculpture, of the use of carving. And that is that when the sculptor gets a block of marble, which this material is, or a block of stone, they have to gauge exactly the proportions. They have to kind of understand how they're going to work not only from top to bottom, but in three dimensions. And if you have a figure that's not like this, right? If you have a figure that's twisted or turned or whatever, You can't be absolutely sure that you've got it right. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine what he's having to do, what he's trying to do? Well, he abandoned work on the bubbly slice because he really felt that it just didn't work. He couldn't get that figure out of the marble. He had to take away things from the marble, but he couldn't imagine actually finishing it. Can you see how the proportions would be a problem here? If he were to continue on with this carving, Olivia, you had your hand up.
I was going to ask the medium.
It's marble. So, I mean, yeah, subtractive sculpture involves carving, and you can work in wood, you can work in stone, you can use metal, you can use ivory, you can use bone, you can even use plastics. Some people use plastics. But the whole notion is that you cut away from the original block of material. It's a test of skill, and it involves real risk, as we've been seeing, because it's impossible to replace the portions that once have been cut away. In this way, there's a very close analogy to what? Another medium that we've been talking about. Rose.
Temple. I'm not sure.
I bet you were right. Try it.
I was going to say when you paint on the wall, but I just forgot what it was.
Yeah, it could be like fresco, which Taylor talks about in a way. But try something else. It's even more analogous. Remember what we just saw? What?
The etchings.
Yeah. The etchings, well, but even more, if you're cutting away something. Woodcuts, yeah. The duraflagellation that we looked at last time. It's really analogous to that. You've got to have it on the ball. You really have to, because once you slip or make a mistake, you're in deep doo-doo. And I mean, if you can't finish it up. And such artists as Michelangelo did screw up. What happens is that, what usually happens in the first stage, though, of carving on stone, which is really difficult. I mean, we talked about how difficult it is to get that little detail in when you're doing wood carving, and then also when you're doing engraving. Well, here you've got to imagine that you need to have, at least with Durer, he had a little knife, you know what I mean? He had a little knife, and he was managing it with his hand, right? And when he did etchings, he was managing it again with his hand and his fingers. He had control over this part of his arm. Now, this is heavy labor. So to carve stone, especially stone of this size, we're not talking about a Venus of Willendorf size stone, which is you can hold in your hand. Here we're talking about a block of marble that's bigger than the artist, right? So these are more than life size. And in order to get down into it, you've got to do this really heavy labor. You've got to do a lot of chipping and hammering. Wait, let me make sure I've told you all the different. So the first thing that you have to do is you have to kind of hew out a rough shape. And what you can see is that here's the rough shape that he's worked at. But you can also see how he's done it. You know, it's a really labor-intensive process because you can't just cut away, you know what I mean? Think of a block of marble. You have to kind of take tools and hammer and chip away the marble. You see it? And what you can do is you can actually see Michelangelo working here on the marble in various ways. And you can see how this was the original very rough-hewn block, right? And then he goes in closer and he starts doing detail, and then his strokes have to become finer and finer. Now, what I'd like you to do is to all come up to see this, because you need to see the different kinds of textures that come when you're doing rough labor and fine chipping. You know what I mean? And you can see that right here. You can see all this stuff right around here. Look in here and get in close and take a look at the detail. Now, and then take a look at this area so you can get a sense of what's going on. So just come on up. Come on either side and don't block the light. Good. Did you see it?
Yeah, I didn't.
Yeah, you can see it. And see the two different ones. Actually, there are a bunch of different kinds. Do you see? This is one right here. See all those little thingies? That's the detail. This is the heavier chipping out. You can actually, you just see that you just put a tool up here and went bang, 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 bang. Yeah. See, look at these little lines here. See the little.
What did they use for that?
There are all sorts of different tools, and Taylor illustrates them actually. He shows you all the different tools in his book. But you know, you realize that you have to have this incredible combination of strength and delicacy. You know what I mean? You've got to have the kind of the attention to detail. You have to have the attention to detail that you saw in that Durer engraving, but the power, you know, of a heavy laborer. I mean, someone who's doing things like breaking up stones in the sidewalk. It's really, really difficult work. So. Once you get into this stage, what happens is that your tools get smaller and smaller, and finally at the end you're working with a kind of abrasive, like a pumice stone or a sandpaper or something like that, getting things down to polish level. So it is really, but I think it's incredibly exciting because you can get, you get a real sense of how Michelangelo worked. Okay, so be sure to take a look at the Taylor section on tools, on the various tools, and imagine them being used on this stuff. Let me show you some more unfinished Michelangelo sculptures. Julius decided that he would abandon work on the tomb for a while, and he set Michelangelo to painting the Sistine ceiling. Michelangelo really wanted to finish this thing. He likes carving much better than painting, but he got stuck for 3 years doing the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. So here again, you can get it. Can you see the detail here? Here's the detail of the head, and you can really see that kind of fine chipping away. Michelangelo said that he when he looked at blocks of stone, he really he had to choose a block of stone and then discover the figure inside of it. But these guys didn't get discovered, or they kind of got half discovered. You can see these if you go to Florence in Italy and see them. They're at the Academia, which is the sculpture, one of the places where you can see sculptures in Florence. Okay, so let's look at a finished Michelangelo sculpture so that we can make the comparison between an unfinished and finished and see how refined his surfaces became. This is the Pietà of Michelangelo, which is spelled P-I-E-T-A. And it's one of those standard subjects like the flagellation foot.
Do you know what that means?
Yes. Do you know what that means? Yes. Do you know what that means?
It means mercy.
Yes, it means mercy. That's right. Or pity.
I just learned that yesterday.
Let's see. Okay, so it's the and it's the moment after Christ is pulled down from the cross and his mother, Mary, cradles him in her arms, cradles the body of the dead Jesus Christ. I'm going to give you I want you to see the whole sculpture before I show you a close up so you can see the texture. It's really gorgeous.
Where is it?
This work.
Beth, is that one in Florence also?
Yeah. That's true.
Yeah. Here's the face of the Virgin, Mary, and let's put it up against the face of the bubbly slave. So that you can see what the bubbly slave would have looked like if it had been finished. Now, probably he wouldn't have had as refined a surface for a male slave figure as he does for the Virgin Mary, but it would be pretty close. But you can see now, And what I'd like you to do is come up really close and look at the surface of this. You can see that he's really gotten to the point where you almost can't see it. But if you get in close, you can see. You can still see the texture. You can see the tools at work. From a distance, it's hard for you to see, but if you come up close, you can see that. But you can also see the incredible detail that he gets. Look at her when you get up here. Look at the eyelids. They're really extraordinary. Look at the fold in the lip. Look at the bones underneath the neck and the collarbone, where he gives you the suggestion of bones underneath the flesh. Look at the folds of the cloak around her, and remember, this is marble, right? This is material that's like this, where you really have to, you're still working really hard, and yet he gets a sense of cloth, the texture of cloth, the folds of the cloth. It's really a stunning performance. This is like, this is like Durer and the Melancholy. This is really an amazing guy. He's not a bad painter, too. So why don't you come on up and, again, get in real close. I mean, stand to the side, don't stand in front of the light. But so that you can see the texture, because it's there. It's there. You can see the stone there. And then compare it with this. Can you see it? Don't stand in front of the light. You just have to stand to the side. Can you see what I'm talking about? Can you see actually, I can't even see it from here. But you have to kind of get in there. I go sit on the floor. Get in there on the floor. And you can see. Do you see that the striations there on the face?
But that's not just the screen.
Yeah, I'm sure.
No, it's not the screen. Could it be the photo, but I don't think so. Because look, they're different. You know what I mean? But look how it suggests her eyebrows. I think that's supposed to be a suggestion of a band around her head.
That's not going to be that.
Is there a crap in there?
No. Now, do you know what happened with the Pietà probably 8-10 years ago? Someone walked into St. Peter's, where it is now, and had a hammer and smashed the foot. I mean, at least it was up on a pedestal. So
why?
People
are stupid.
Just the
foot?
So now, this is very, it's very difficult to... We'll give you some more details so that you can see how refined and detailed and suggestive you can get a sculpture. This is the head of Christ.
Looks like a swashbuckler.
And again, notice the area around the neck, and this time take a look at the hair. The detail of the hair, and again the eyebrows, and Christ has a little goatee. No, get it any closer. Here's the left hand of the Virgin. And there you can see the joint to a there is a part that he had to kind of solder on. I don't know how they did it. They had some kind of a strut.
I think they
an iron strut.
They drill a
strut,
hole into
yeah.
it.
And yeah, and then stick it in.
Is that the only piece? That one thumb is the only piece. That
I think there are other places. I think there are other places, but I mean, look at the other thing. This what's so extraordinary about that hand is how alive it is. You know, And then take a look at the pads of flesh on the palm. It's really amazing. And the joints underneath the thumb and the fingernails. It's really an extraordinary achievement. And the wrist, how the wrist, the delicacy of the wrist, and how he suggests the veins and the small bones of the wrist underneath it. It's really amazing.
That Mary's hand?
Yeah, that's the Virgin's hand. That's Mary's hand.
It's a nice hand, but the thumb is kind of masculine. Maybe I'm just crazy.
No, she's big.
Yeah, she has to. This is a big guy in her lap. But
but that one thumb is kind of anachronistic.
Well, I think all the fingers are kind of big.
Really?
Yeah, well, I mean,
it's like a callus on her thumb.
Wait, what do you mean? That?
Is that a callus on her thumb, or is that the bone?
Well, no, but see that, you see that ridge? Kind of?
Show me on the slide. Just get up and show me.
You're right. You shouldn't have finished this.
He should have started all over. I think it's a reflection.
Yeah,
this wasn't very good. We'll send a letter to the Vatican. And the other thing that you have to understand too is that Michelangelo did, most of the Renaissance artists, study anatomy. He studied anatomy by dissecting corpses, and so he knew very well what was underneath the flesh, and he works very hard to represent that. It's quite what it's analogous to is when Berger talks about the rise of illusionism again with oil painting, and artists try very hard to create the textures of things and the exact color of things and deep space, a real illusion of the real world on the surface of the canvas. Here Michelangelo is attempting to do that same kind of mimicking, but in sculpture. And he develops all sorts of techniques to do it. He's someone who brings it along in an incredible way. I mean, he's really a person who begins to kind of explain in stone what the human body is all about. So, anyway, the texture of marble is really special in that you can, if you're good at it, you can really mimic those effects. But it still has a quality that's all its own. You can kind of feel the coldness of it in a way. You can get a very highly polished surface. I want to show you another subtractive work by a Renaissance artist that's done not in marble but in stone. I'm sorry, not in marble but in wood. And here it is. This is Mary Magdalene.
That's gross.
Another Christian figure. Does anybody want to explain who Mary Magdalene is? Does anybody know who Mary Magdalene is?
She's the
prostitute
that Christ redeemed.
Tell the story, someone.
She washed Jesus' feet with her hair.
And her tears.
She was like a a dirty old prostitute.
Very old prostitute.
Well, that's what I said.
I don't think she was an old prostitute.
I think she was.
Yes. What?
She saw Jesus wanted to be redeemed and cried and washed his feet with her tears and her hair. And he redeemed her.
Right. So he's the prostitute that that Mary, that's why she has long hair. And she's the prostitute who becomes a saint through contact with Christ and through a long period of repentance in the wilderness. And what you see is Donatello's image of Mary Magdalene after her years of repentance. And he uses not marble but wood so that he can get a kind of a craggy quality that you can't get with sculpture.
Did Michelangelo use wood sculptures?
What? I don't know. They did discover a wooden cross that some people claimed was by Michelangelo, but I don't know. I mean, I don't know of anyone that's kind of standard. I mean, I'm just works that, like, there are a lot of Renaissance books that are lost. We just don't know anything.
Yeah, she's in the nightmares.
Shut this down. See this better. And what you can see here, especially if you look at the eyes, the hollow of the eyes, and the way the skin is depicted. And the way her hair, she's wearing a hair shirt. In addition to her hair, but that, can you see how the texture of the wood really affects the quality of the sculpture? The kind of effect of the sculpture. So you really need, when you're writing about sculpture, when you're doing sculptural analysis, you have to take into account the medium. Okay, let's take a look now at the additive process, which is totally different. Let's take a look. The additive process actually begins to get used, really becomes popular. Sorry, in the 19th century, although there were lots of additive sculptors before that. But I'm going to show you the example, an example from the 19th century. This is by the 19th century sculptor Rodin, R-O-D-I-N. And let's talk a little bit about how this demonstrates at the additive process. First of all, you start by not taking away, but by what's called modeling. You add to rather than take away. You use malleable plastic materials such as clay, wax, or plasticine, which is clay mixed with wax and mineral oil. And that allows the artist really great freedom in building up and modifying the form. Modeling is a lot, is really in some ways analogous to oil painting. You have a chance to fuss around with it. You can change it. You can, you know, you can. You've got time to work with this stuff and mold it. It takes another kind of strength, but it doesn't. You know, one thing about the modeling process. Actually, I'll ask you if you can figure this out. What is the difference between the tools that you would use for modeling and the tools that you would use for carving? And how does that affect how the artist does this? What do you get to do when you model? You've all modeled clay, right?
So using softer tools.
Yeah, you use softer tools. What's your main tool in the beginning?
Your hands.
Your hands, yeah. And that makes a huge difference, the hands and what the hands can do. In fact, if you look closely on this, you can actually see the way you can some oil paint. When we looked at the Monet, you can see the hands of the artists imprinted in what used to be the clay. And let's see if we can get,
like, around the right eye, it looks like.
Yeah, you can.
Around the right eye and cheek.
Yeah, you can see. You know, you can see him doing something like that. Why don't you come up close? Or look at the lip. There's another place where you can kind of see. So, guys, come on. Can you see him just taking his thumb and doing some of those things, or his little finger? Pressing it down. Can you see? And can you see the things that are added on, like the beard? Yeah. The beard and the hair. You can see little patches of things that are just kind of placed on. You can see that. Or I'll put another cookie. Yeah, just stay there if you want. Actually, why don't you just stay there? You know what? You could sit on the floor if you want to move the table. Does anybody want to move the table? Okay, just sit up here and don't go back.
Is this like sitting too close to the
table?
No,
it isn't.
No.
Let me show you another one. happens is that you get this clay wax or plasticine, and you make this figure in clay, right? And the hands themselves are the primary tool, right? For big works like this one, this is a portrait of Balzac, B-A-L-Z-A-C, the sculptor, the writer, the 19th century writer, by Rodin. And for big things like this, you need what's called an armature. Should I spell that for you? A-R-M-A-T-U-R-E, an armature. Which means that you have some kind of a support system on which you can build the clay. And let me show you. I'll show you an armature here. Here's a sculpture that you can, where you actually can see the armature. There. This is a sculpture by Degas, the French Impressionist painter, which never got finished. But you can see that he had. That he was building up his clay around this armature. Do you see that? And then there's the strut. So he would have had one. He would have had one in the leg, one in the leg, and this would have probably had an armature as well.
So would he have ended up cutting that ball that's sticking in the river away?
I think so. But it looks like it's at the point where he certainly couldn't. What?
No, nothing.
But see, you can see, the thing is that you have to get the sculpture so it can be freestanding. That's a kind of a problem. You've got to get it balanced right. So the armature helps. I mean, likely he would have it cut away.
What's going on behind it? What's that white stuff?
Oh, I think it's the slide. Don't you think? I don't know. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it looks like it's...
But can you also see on the Degas the kind of fingerprints of the artist?
On the Degas.
Yeah, on the Degas, the dancer. You can see the fingerprints of the artist and how he's
what
molding.
What is that meaning? Is that clay?
What? No, this is actually bronze. We're going to talk about it. What happens is that the clay, of course, isn't going to last, right? So you have to cast it. You have to do something with it. And I'll show you something in just a minute. Wait.
Aren't almost all of these hollow?
Hollow?
Yeah,
the bronze?
Yeah, hollowed so that...
Yeah, you have to hollow so it doesn't blow up.
Yeah.
Yeah. The bronze. Now, this isn't... This is not bronze. This is plaster. And we're going to... Let me explain that, how that works.
Oh, good job. The wise hollow. Tony's going to...
You're a wise guy.
After you've modeled the wax or the whatever it is, the clay you're going to do, the next thing that you do is you're going to cast the sculpture in plaster. That's the first step, and that's what you're seeing up on the screen over on the right. So, it's and the plaster cast is going to be used to make the final work in bronze. A plaster cast is a lot more durable and easier to handle than clay or wax. So what happens is that when the clay or wax or plasticine model is ready, plaster of Paris is used to form a mold. The mold is then cast in bronze or some other durable material. So what you're seeing there is the plaster mold on the right side, or left side, on your left. You're seeing the plaster mold that Rodin used to cast his final bronze project, his final bronze sculpture. So, and you know what casting is? Do you know what casting is? Mm-hmm. Taylor explains it. It's you give shape to a substance by pouring in a liquid or plastic form into a mold and letting it harden. So molten bronze is poured into this mold, and then it's left to harden, and then the plaster is chipped away, and you have your sculpture. So let me show you the finished product here.
Yeah.
That's super cute.
I don't see the cat. Show me the cat.
I see the cat.
Yeah,
it's
not
it's
little funny nose of cat, mouth of cat, chin is open, that's like little.
It's smiling,
isn't
it?
That's
a
smile.
I see it totally.
Different.
I don't know.
Yeah.
It's multiple
products.
Man, that
is
awesome.
Does anybody
know where this is?
Is that in Amsterdam?
Does anybody know where this is?
Amsterdam.
No.
Germany.
No. 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 Oh, not Michigan. Do you recognize? You don't recognize the band?
Is it New York?
Yes. New York. New York. And that brings up the next thing that you have to consider with sculpture. You not only have to consider that sculpture is three-dimensional and you have to go all around it, but the other thing that you have to consider about sculpture is site, the site of it. Where is it? Because the site makes a huge difference in the impact of the sculpture. This is the Balzac, cast bronze Balzac in New York, in the sculpture garden of the Museum of Modern Art. And what's around him makes him look rather heroic, I think, or like a very eccentric sightseer.
You see, in the picture on the left, it's such an ugly sculpture.
Yeah.
And the picture on the right, compared to like the drab skyline and like the scraggly trees,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't look quite so terrible.
Okay.
How tall is this?
How tall is this? Life size. A little bit more than life size, actually. Now, the thing about the casting is that you can actually cast a whole bunch of things. I mean, once you've got a mold, you can cast a whole number of things. And so there are more than one bronze Balzacs all around. There's one in Paris, in the middle of at the Place de la République. There's one on the terrace of Rodin's old house, and I'm going to show that to you. Oops, I just dropped. Overlooking the terrace of
Rodin's
house, yeah, in Meudon, which is in France, Meudon. So you can go visit it there too, in addition to the sculpture garden. So sight is really important, and sight participates in what comes to be the iconography of the sculpture. I'm going to ask you now a question. Do any of you know the, I don't have a slide of it, but do any of you know the sculpture that's on the grounds of Rackham's?
Sorry?
The rack of the
one on the building on the side?
No. Well, yeah, the one on the side.
The Holocaust one?
The Holocaust one, right.
Yeah.
Do you know the Holocaust one?
Yeah, where he's holding his hand.
Yeah, where he's holding his hand. So it's a monument to the Holocaust, and it's on the grounds of Rackham. Now, why do you think that site was chosen?
Was Rackham Jewish?
No. It's on the grass, correct? Why would they put it there?
So, high viewing?
Because the garden that it's in is, I don't know, something to do with the garden?
Mm-hmm, yeah, thing.
Light?
No. Well, partly. Think
like
of what do you think that ground? What do you think that ground could have been? Dirt is good.
Maybe it was East Pond was used by the army during World War II for Japanese language training, so maybe they did something over there.
Could be. Yeah, that could be. What about ground though? Think about ground. Maybe I'm not giving you enough hints. What?
Like,
yeah,
graves.
What?
Flowers grow up out of
the
ground.
That's not new. You can't just break
it. What kind of a gray hair do you think it would be have been?
Is it a mass grave?
No. No, they didn't have.
They just found it.
Not that I know of. What kind of a cemetery might it have been?
A Jewish cemetery?
Excellent.
It was a Jewish cemetery.
Yeah, it's the old Jewish
cemetery.
It's the site of
the old...
It's the site of the old Jewish cemetery in Ann Arbor.
Okay, so
weird.
What happened to the bodies?
What?
Are they still there?
What, say that again?
Did they move the bodies? Are they still there? There's...
I really don't know. I think it's built over. I mean, a lot of weird. I think.
Yeah, that's the kind of information like you can go your whole life without knowing.
That's true. But now once I tell you that, though, doesn't that affect your perception of the sculpture or no? Or when you walk past the sculpture, are you not going to feel different about it or no?
Actually, probably. Yeah, I'll probably feel different about it.
Okay. What? What is that?
Sexism.
No, because it's in either case, it's still a chilling reminder of tragedy.
Yeah.
Well,
grave,
none of those
graveyards.
Oh, you mean
the
statue?
I mean, because it's kind of, in a way, it's kind of a tombstone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's and that's the other connection too. You want to talk about that, Raoul Wallenberg.
I know briefly he was an architecture student at the University of Michigan from, was it Hungary? I forget where, but regardless, he was from Europe. And
is that Sweden?
Huh?
Is that Sweden?
It might have been Sweden.
Whatever.
Anyway, so he was called back to Europe to be some kind of administrative assistant in the embassy, and he used that position to help funnel Jews out of Europe into the United States.
Yeah.
And it's believed that he died in a Russian prison camp, but they don't know.
Yeah, but he got thousands of Jews out.
All the Scandinavians were doing stuff like that. The Swedish and the Finnish, I think. Weren't they all smuggling
Jews? They were
Jews?
Taking them in. Yeah, they were taking them in.
Yeah. They're Norwegian. That's
hiding them.
It was the Danish.
Okay, so it's important to know when you're considering the meaning of a sculpture, that is the iconography of a sculpture, you need to not only know what the sculpture is of or about, but where it's placed and why it's placed there, because usually there's a reason for why a sculpture is put in a certain place. There's usually a pretty good reason for why. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a little... test case here. I'm going to give you some hints. I'm going to give you some hints about this, okay? I'm going to give you some hints about it, and what I'm hoping to do is that if I give you, I'm trying to give you just enough hints and show you just enough so that you can figure out what the site, why the site is what it is.
Okay?
All right. So what I'm going to show you is if anybody, this is a sculpture by an Italian. It's done in the 17th century. It is a sculpture for a fountain. And the fountain is called the Fountain of the Four Rivers. So, and it's in this place in Italy called the Piazza Navona.
Piazza Navona?
Piazza Navona. I'm going to put it on the board so that if you go there. Also, there's this great restaurant right near it called the Tre Scalini. And they serve these fabulous things called chocolate tartufo. It's really good. So I'll also put the restaurant down. The restaurant is
Trace
Gully.
Okay. So
our
trip to New York.
Okay, so let me show you. God, this is going to make a lot of noise. Okay, here's a long view of this fountain called the Fountain of the Four Rivers. And this is just the piazza or plaza where it's located. But take it in, okay?
Well, I've seen that.
Wait a minute.
No, it's not.
Yeah, there's no McDonald's right behind. Is that across the street from the Parthenon?
Okay, so it's in this piazza. And just notice, can you just try to notice the buildings around it? And notice also that it is a fountain, okay? There's another view of the piazza.
I'm not sure I understand
the section.
I almost said sexual.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Obviously. Just some books.
Okay, four major rivers of the world. Four rivers of the world are represented on this fountain. Here's the first one. This is the Nile. They're personifications of each of the rivers. This is the Nile. Okay? Then you have... What?
Nothing.
The guy's saying, I
you
heard
guys.
Get my shirt.
All right, listen. And this is the Ganges. Another river.
Which one?
Danube.
Yeah.
I think this is the Danube. Wait a minute.
Yeah, that's what they're going to rock.
No, it's the Ganges.
Oh, my God.
Actually, that's not true.
Yeah,
seriously.
Yep,
yeah,
this is the Ganges.
And
ketchup.
Okay.
Is that a
serpent?
Yeah,
the
other one.
Oh, God.
You're such a
who said that?
Olivia.
Okay, you guys, this is the Danube.
Who made this?
Yeah, who did make
it? Wait, there's somebody in the front.
Yeah,
there's
a child.
This is
a child.
Okay, and this is the fourth and final river, the Plata.
Is this somebody in there?
Who is this?
Okay.
Wait, what river is that?
Alright, guys, cut it.
Beth, what river
what?
Was it? What's the fourth river?
This is the Plata.
What?
The Plata River.
No Amazon.
Okay,
what
the
is that?
Plata River.
No Mississippi.
There's no Mississippi.
Okay.
So there's the Nile. Now think about this. Listen
okay.
to this. There's the Nile.
Yes.
Which is where? Africa. There's the Ganges.
India.
There's the Danube.
Turkey.
Danube.
No,
da, 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 da.
Yeah, the Blue Danube.
Where is the Blue Danube?
Excellent.
It flows through Vienna, but it also is in Hungary. Okay, the Danube and the Plata. Where is the Plata?
Spain.
What?
Spain?
Nope.
Italy?
Nope.
What is the name?
The Plata, Plata.
Greece.
Someone said it.
Greece?
Nope.
South
America. Okay, so what do you have represented in these four rivers? Think of it. Think about it. Yeah.
Global representation.
And not the Amazon.
Yeah, I know.
Well, they decided on the Plata. So you've got one thing in South America, one thing in Egypt, one thing in Europe, and one thing in Asia. All four continents. Or five. Well, they don't have anything in Greenland. What's the fifth? I never know. What's
Antarctica.
The other? Antarctica. They don't have it. But all inhabited continents are represented. And
well,
I want you to especially take a look at these two figures and what they're doing. What are they doing?
Falling.
Falling, okay. Do they seem to be... What do they seem
no,
to be
No, they're playing.
They're playing?
All four of them are playing a game.
What happened to
us? They're playing beach ball. No.
No,
they are playing beach ball. Okay, I'm going to give you another hint.
Okay.
Just a minute.
Who created the sculpture?
I think it makes my doesn't figure out.
I'll tell you later.
That's why I should have any other time.
Yeah.
What's wrong with the Plata instead?
Is that his ear in the front of his head?
Yeah, I can figure that out.
It's like
all their beards. Looking at the sun.
Oh, is that the basilica?
Lit.
It is?
It is, yes. It's a church. It's a church.
Oh, they're scared of Lisbon. They're bowing down to
Yeah, they're all prostrating themselves to the Christian diaspora.
Well, I don't know what they are the Christian. I mean, they are.
Too much effort.
The church, all right, the church that you're seeing. That they're all looking up at so thrilled by, or whatever, is the church that you're seeing is the Church of St. Agnes, Santa Agnese. And it is a church that is particularly associated with something, aside from the Catholic Church. It does something. What does it do? I mean, this...
Saint
Agnes,
the patron saint or something?
No. Someone said it.
Missionary?
You got it. They're missionary.
Yeah.
It's a missionary church.
Yeah.
Wait, what's the deal with just plot the head on him?
He's looking up.
Where's his face?
There's his
nose.
Deers.
There's like his ear.
Oh, his hair.
That's his eye. So that's his chin.
So
like
I thought that was
bald, but he has
his
face down there.
Look, isn't that the back?
Bald.
No.
Yeah, that's the back of him.
Yeah.
He's bald.
Oh, this is it.
Yeah. Still
so
back
like
in his head.
He has
so he's looking up at the church. He's looking up at the church. And there happens to be an obelisk. I mean, I don't know if the slides, but there happens to be an obelisk in the center. And on the obelisk is the insignia of the Pope. Okay? So the thing about this is that in the 17th century, you got it. I mean, you basically got it. There was a real push to send missionaries all around the world and make countries Catholic or convert the heathen and
do the Lord's work.
Do the Lord's work, right. And so what happens is that these figures are reacting, they represent the four rivers of the world all overwhelmed by the church. Now, do you remember there's one figure that's not looking up?
Yeah, the first one.
The Nile.
Yeah.
Yes.
The Nile. What's going on with the Nile?
The Nile.
That's right.
Oh, my God.
Okay.
That was terrific.
Oh, my God. Oh, God. The Nile's in denial.
Okay, let's go back and find him. Sorry, I'm going to tell you. Here is the Nile. And you'll notice that the Nile has a cover over his head. Right?
Blind.
He is still in the dark.
Oh, he hasn't seen the light.
No, he hasn't seen the light. He's not able to see the light. Because they aren't converted yet.
Because
so the other ones were converted already?
Well, I think they thought they were making inroads on the other ones, but they were doing so well.
They got the obelisk.
They did get the obelisk, that's right.
So
but the inroads, they were not doing.
You know that there's like something sort of like this in front of the Pantheon in Rome?
Mm-hmm.
It's like
a fountain.
No, it's not a fountain, but it's an obelisk with like
mm-hmm.
a cross on top. It's other, like something underneath, like it's empire on top of empire on top of empire, and the great part is that they built a McDonald's behind it.
Oh, God.
Another iconographic.
I wrote a paper about it.
There
McDonald's.
You go. That's it.
That
is McDonald's. So the important thing is you need to find out not only kind of what's going on in the sculpture, but what is the relationship to the site. That's really, really mucho important. Okay, and that concludes our very exciting discussion of sculpture today, the last day before spring vacation. On Saturday, now when you get your papers back.
Do you have any extra sheets on the next writing assignment?
extra sheets on the next assignment. I should have them in my book, but if I don't. Let me hang on.
Oh,
jeez.
It's a good thing I'm so nimble.
This is probably the worst class I've ever been to.
Oh, no, I was a nursing student.
Oh, really? You were? Oh,
okay. I'm just a nursing student.
So you know.
Amsterdam.
I'm going to Virginia.
Is anyone really going to Amsterdam? Stop. Are you going, Brody?
Yeah.
Oh, I want to show you Brody's.
You're going to Amsterdam?
Brody did this great cover for his for his paper. But where is my
bank? Are you flying for $300? How much are you flying for?
Sorry.
Yeah,
but,
Multiple colors, here's the
red eyes and
it's just like seeing like what all the things you're seeing come together.
Excellent cover.
But he's like, no, it's a treasure.
Caitlin. You all did pretty good, I have to say. Laura? Simon.
Beth, I'm sorry I didn't include I meant to include the ads that I was writing about, but I think I figured if you'd seen them.
Okay,
so.
Tim. And Tim, I have all your, these kept falling, you should have put these kept falling out of my back. And I'm falling all the time. This is like, I'm getting falling out of my back.
One of them is right. The other one's right.
Well, that's fine. Now, is this your
Are you really?